And to call the meeting of the Senate Transportation Committee to order on Thursday, March 14th. It says February 14th, but I think it's March 14th. So Dana's still on Valentine's Day, Dana Owen, staff to Senate Transportation. Also, welcome Ann Krickelberg, our secretary for today, and teleconference operator Henry DeCherney. And we have two items on the agenda for today. Number one is the presentation on the Old Harbor Airport expansion. And we have Cynthia Burns Lopez, VP of Corporate Affairs for OHNC, Old Harbor Neighborhood Corporation, okay. And Carl Mars. Carl, welcome back to the legislature, CEO and President of OHNC. Thank you. Welcome. Again, I apologize for being late today, and other members of the committee will be showing up.
No apologies.
Shortly. Have at it, and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for giving us this opportunity to testify on issues important to the community of Old Harbor. With me today is Cynthia Burns, Vice President of Corporate Affairs, and Richard Wiebe, who's our project manager and civil engineer at Shearwater Systems. My name is Carl Mars. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Old Harbor Native Corporation. Because I know you have limited time, I'll give you about a 30,000-foot view of our plan, and Cynthia and Richard can fill in the holes. We're here today to talk about the airport expansion project that is taking place in Old Harbor, a project which began construction last year. You may ask, why are we expanding the runway? Well, the answer to that is it's been in the works for some time, but it's always been too costly. Our community was dying. When Governor Parnell was running for governor, he challenged rural Alaska to help figure out ways to improve economic opportunities, to build communities and stop the out-migration. He challenged us to think about public-private partnerships, to think outside the box. So that's what we did. Through a lot of meetings and planning, we came up with a plan to revitalize Old Harbor. But in order to do it, we had to get the tribe, the city, and the Native Corporation all working for the same priorities and objectives. We succeeded in that. Every 6 months, we meet in Old Harbor to make sure everybody's still on the same page. When issues come up, we work through them. We've been successful with this approach. We truly had to be creative and think outside the box. How do we complete these projects efficiently? We structured this project in a manner that allows collaboration between the state, the city, the tribe, the village corporation, and the federal government. We believe we've achieved those goals and will save the state tens of millions on this project. I'm going to turn it over to Cynthia to quickly show you all of the elements that we believe will create the new economy in Old Harbor for many years to come and stop the out-migration of people from Old Harbor.
Great. Thanks, Carl. And again, I apologize because things have been so rushed this afternoon. I want to introduce Senator Hollis French on the committee and myself, Chair Senator Egan. And again, we apologize that we're late. And we're not trying to avoid you, but we're looking at the TV screen that has the same thing.
Understood.
As the thing in the back. Anyway, sorry.
It's always good to see some Senator French.
And we also welcome Senator Fred Dyson, Vice Chair of Transportation.
Chairman.
You missed the part that was important. That was me, but Senator, it was good to see you.
Always delighted to see you.
Cynthia, it's your turn.
All right. Chairman Egan and committee members, thank you for your time today. My name is Cynthia Burns, and I'm Vice President of Corporate Affairs for the Old Harbor Native Corporation. I was raised in Old Harbor, and my position at the Old Harbor Native Corporation I work very closely with the city and tribe on economic development to sustain a healthy community. As Carl mentioned, our city, our tribe, and our village corporation have been working together very closely to reach our visions and goals that were established in our community plan in 2005. We have a very strong, healthy, renewable resource of seafood and the strongest fishing fleet in of all the villages on Kodiak Island. Our fish resource is our economic driver and can provide additional revenue and opportunities for the residents, the city of Old Harbor, Kodiak Island Borough, and the state of Alaska. We've been successful in building the new small boat harbor to support our fishing fleet and the city dock that can support the Testamina and Kennecott. Both these projects were completed on time and under budget. Currently, we are working on the airport expansion and the hydroelectric project. All of these projects are essential infrastructure in our multi-pronged economic development efforts leading to a fish processing plant in our community. We hold the biannual leadership summit where our community members come together to establish priorities, provide infrastructure updates on programs and projects, and strategic planning. Our community recognizes the importance of working together to strengthen our economy and promote a healthy community. The Old Harbor Airport project has been in the works for several years. We had to be very creative to get this project moving forward. Therefore, we are utilizing all resources available to our community. Our village corporation is providing the additional land for the extension in kind to the state of Alaska, which DOT estimated at approximately $450,000. The Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge is providing the subsurface rock for the expansion. And through the Aleutic Tribe of Old Harbor, we utilized the Civil Works Program for the completion of the environmental assessment and the permitting. This cost-shared program has reduced the cost for these tasks in half. A key component to the airport project is the Department of Defense Innovative Readiness Training Program. This program will provide substantial savings by the federal government providing in-kind construction support. We have approved IRT applications for 2013 and 14 that were submitted collaboratively by the City of Old Harbor and State of Alaska Department of Transportation. Through the IRT program, the Marine Corps will provide operators, equipment, fuel, and their own food and housing support for the project. We're working closely with DOT to ensure they're well informed on the project. This is a state-owned airport and will remain a state-owned airport. Our community just had to get very creative to complete this infrastructure project. That will ultimately allow us to reach our goal of building the economy with a fresh fish processing plant in our village. Next, Richard will provide a brief overview of our airport project.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This slide represents...
Can you give your name?
Oh, Richard Wiebe. I'm civil engineer and project manager for the air runway extension project. The image in front of you is the conditions as they existed about a year ago prior to any new work being done. The runway was constructed in 1992. It has a small apron, a maintenance building, and one land is leased for one private hangar at the facility. It is unpaved and unlighted. Next slide. This is a little difficult to see, but I think in your packets it's probably more legible. The existing runway had a object-free zone of 400 feet in width. We are going to increase that to 500 feet in width. And the original runway cut through a ridge such that on the west side of the runway, there was a bluff about 80 feet high, and on the east side, it was about 60 feet high. So that doesn't meet the FAA slope requirements, so those hills will be cut back at 7-1, and the tow moved 50 feet further from the center line. We will have quite a bit of fill on the extension up to 55 feet in depth at the northern end. This basically just shows you the slopes that are planned, 3-1 on the south end, and then 4-1 where we have some marine fill. This indicates the work that was completed this past construction season. The area shown in pink is where we have removed overburden in preparation for blasting, and the areas in blue is where the overburden was spoiled. We did receive a 404 and a 401 permit, which will allow us to spoil additional organic material and excess material within these locations. The total volumes moved will be somewhere between 1.9 and 2.2 million cubic yards. The range is somewhat dependent on what we encounter as the depth of organic material in the expansion area, and also there's a little variation in the expansion of material as you loosen it up. Majority of the fill will be on the north end, over 600,000 cubic yards, and the south end around 140,000 cubic yards. Go ahead. The plan for this coming construction season is Shearwater, with its forces, will begin work in April through June and work in this area in further preparation for the IRT's arrival June 1st. As part of our secondary mission, we were challenged to hire and train local operators. The tribe, the city, and the corporation provided scholarships to send three individuals to training. They were employed along with some others that already had experience. There's further plans for four more scholarships, two for truck drivers and two for operators this year. So the vast majority of our workforce has been locally hired, between full-time and part-time, 14 local hires. Once the IRT arrives, we will segregate the work areas so that we don't commingle and have conflicts with our operations or their operations. We will do some blasting in April and May prior to their arrival to generate enough material for their work season. Then once they arrive, we will move to the southeast side and work on the extension to the south. Prior to their arrival, we will push a haul road out, and we have to put in a temporary crossing across the creek at the north end for their access. Construction or grading plans are essentially 90 to 95% complete. This is the southern end where the about 300-foot extension. We have a couple streams that will need to be rerouted around the fill area, and we've been working closely with the Game and Fish in terms of how to design those facilities. We conducted fish studies throughout this past season on a monthly basis and characterized these streams. Then on the north end, that's about a 1,700-foot extension all the way out to the point. And as I mentioned, we will have to reroute what's been named Sculpin Creek and divert it out to Midway Bay and avoid having to install a costly culvert. We're also constructing a temporary pad for construction activities, staging equipment. And then when we get to the point of the final subbase and finish course, that's where the crushing operation will occur, and it would be outside the object-free area. We have two areas of tidal land that will be filled in, one on the east at the outlet of Sculpin Creek, and then a small area on the west side.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. How high is the runway and pad above mean high water?
Its average elevation is around 55.
55?
Yes.
Okay.
There is a slight slope from end to end.
Looking out at the photograph out the bay, it looks like if any tidal wave activity, it'd be pretty sheltered in there, and that would get broken up.
Right. Yeah.
You done any analysis of that?
No, I've been studying that. We have not finalized what we need for the armament on the fill in the marine area. That will not occur until 2014. So basically we need to cut in the new route for the creek and let it heal a season before we divert water and begin filling in that area.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just kind of a high level of activities for this year. The second mod for the 404 permit was issued in February. Public comment closes on March 18th. As I mentioned, grading plans are essentially done. We have a draft safety and blasting plan completed that's being circulated for final review. We will provide that to the Rob Green at the Kodiak Airport, and then he will also receive notifications relative to the blasting and activities on the runway. We have three stream permits that will be submitted shortly, temporary culvert. The Alutech Museum will be doing the field work for the Section 106 archaeological surveys. They did the initial survey this past year and did locate a couple sites that need further investigation. Excuse me. Our shipment of materials for this year should occur this Friday for the first barge run. We are we're adding two fuel tanks to the city's fuel farm to accommodate the fuel demands for the IRT operation as well as ours. This will further enhance the city's opportunity in terms of scheduling barge runs of fuel and also price reductions due to the volume that could be accommodated. As I mentioned, we begin blasting in early April on the west side. Up until the IRT's arrival, then that would move to the east side, extend the Hall Road, Sculpin Creek. The IRT's plans at this point are 3 months of operation, June, July, and August. And next. These are just, this indicates where we did soil borings. There was an extensive geotechnical report from the original runway, so this was primarily used to supplement and confirm that there was consistency in the material from those reports, as well as to take samples in the northern extension, which hadn't been received much boring in the earlier study.
Just one quick question. Do you have time constraints on the when the blasting can occur?
Well, the main concern is if there are sea mammals in the area, right. And we will observe for that and postpone blasting if that's the case.
Okay.
That's the primary issue.
That's part of the permit then.
Yeah. Okay. We're quite a distance from any residents or other things. We will need to notify the folks that have the seismic station above the hill so they they know what's going on. Pardon?
You don't have to worry about the sculpins, though.
No, Well, that concern came up and it was dismissed because we were far enough away that we weren't going to cause an overpressure.
Sorry, I probably continue.
Yeah. So the north end will be somewhat challenging. This table just indicates that we do have a high water table out there, so it's going to be challenging. We're planning on geotech fabric in some of those fill areas as well. We have this past year we operated four 725 articulated dumps. There's three of them. This is characteristic of the West Hillside, where actually we had raked off and harvested some of the material for the development of the pad and some haul roads. Aerial view looking to the northeast, you can see the point. And go ahead to the next one, a little closer. You can see the peninsula up on the upper left-hand corner where the runway will extend all the way up to that point. And then this in the lower right foreground are the areas that have had the overburden removed. And you can see some of the sediment ponds that we had there.
If I can make this go.
These are kind of like family photos, so they get a bit repetitive here. So, but we do have this area back in here to spoil material. So the plan is on the IRT is they would operate loaded, going both directions, hauling spoil back and rock out for the extension. Okay. Still going down. Here you can see the apron and the hangar, and then this about a 300-foot extension on this end. This is another closer view. This is pretty good overall. You can see the treed area at the bottom of the photo. That's where we have to realign some of those streams. This is where we started development of the pad. It will be expanded to the left-hand side where the vegetation is. And you can see we got pretty good quality rock. This was not even compacted with a compactor, just graded out, and the trucks ran over it. And then this is a view of the downtown area. Cynthia mentioned the new boat dock. You can see that in the background. And then this is where we overwintered our equipment, the trucks, a couple dozers, a loader, excavator, and then our supplies are in the sea cans. So I think that's it.
Great, thank you. Questions from the committee?
Just one quick
Senator French.
Thanks. You were able to get $4.5 million last year from the legislature. You're asking for 6.6 this year. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I think we're looking at 6.6 this year. We were looking at seeing if we could get it fully funded, but then we were asked to sort of stretch it out. When we first started the project, we estimated last year it had been about $4.5 million. We got started late, so we're rolling some of that over into this season. Total project cost, depending on what IRT does, whether it's rock crushing or not, somewhere between $14.5 and $18.5 million on the total project cost, versus the $38 million that was originally estimated to do the job. And that's with a collaborative effort with federal, state, village corporation, the tribe, and the village all working together to try to find unique ways to save costs of this thing. In the meantime, you know, we're hiring a lot of people locally, which makes a big difference, training people in something that they can continue in good jobs, operators, truck drivers. They've never had that opportunity before, so it's working out well for the village. The ultimate goal here is to be able to fly fresh fish out of there. If you know where Old Harbor sits on Kodiak Island, there's two canneries, one down in Alitak and those in Kodiak. Well, for these smaller vessels, any of you that's been on the water around there, it's just about impossible to get around those capes. So we have a lot of interest in putting in a fresh fish plant. The extension of this runway would give you the ability to take a DC-6 off if they're fully loaded. So that was the concept behind it, and we do have interest in from companies to build plants in there. So that's what drives that economy down there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Further questions? Seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're all welcome back to the.
Nice to see you again.
And Richard, thank you very much for your presentation. Next, we have Senate Bill 13, Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. And we have Kubota Representatives Mike Foster, Chairman of the Board of Directors. Also, Kevin Hemingway, Chief Financial Officer, and Jeff Stark, Assistant Attorney General, will be making the presentation. We plan on holding the piece of legislation. But so if you guys can come forward, please. Would the sponsor like to make a presentation? Okay, we'll take a brief at ease. convene the Transportation Committee hearing. Jody, if you can state your name and affiliation for the record, please, and present the bill, Senate Bill 13. Kabata.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Simpson, staff to Senator Huggins. I apologize, he was planning on being here, but press of business has meant that he needs to be elsewhere at this moment in time. So if you'll give me a minute to collect my thoughts here and my information,
I'll take your time.
Be right with you. Sorry about that. Okay, good morning, or good afternoon, I'm sorry. Before you have Senate Bill 13, and Senator Huggins is a sponsor, this is a companion bill to House Bill 23, which is being carried by Representative Newman's office. And basically, just for information, because I know many of you, well, probably all three of you, are very familiar with this project. It's been a project that has been discussed and vetted over probably 35 years in South Central and Alaska. So just briefly, an outline of what Senate Bill 13 does. Senate Bill 13 accomplishes three items. It will, A, increase Kubota's bond issuance capacity from $500 million to $600 million. And this will allow Kubota to offer the full allocation of private activity bonds to the private developers to factor into their proposals. B, this Senate Bill 13 will clarify that the bridge is exempt from local property taxes if the private property, the private partner operates the facility on behalf of the state. This puts the bridge, which is always owned by the state, in the same tax-exempt category as all state roads. And C, Senate Bill 13 establishes a project reserve and details the operation of this reserve. The reserve will be the location where the toll revenues, appropriations, and other funds are deposited. And the reserve will also include a reporting and replenishment mechanism subject to your appropriation. Mr. Chairman, these three elements I just mentioned are designed to achieve the best value for the state of Alaska in the public-private partnership that is being used to fund the bridge, to build the bridge. To briefly recap, Kubota was established in 2003 by the legislature under Alaska Statute 19.75 to construct a bridge over the Kinnick Arm between the municipality of Anchorage and the Matsu Borough. In 2006, the legislature amended Kubota's enabling statute to allow the authority to enter into a public-private partnership to finance, design, build, and operate the crossing. Since that time, the authority has followed the direction of the legislature by steadily advancing the project toward construction. There are a couple things, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, just to frame the conversation from the senator's district that he wanted to bring to your attention. And basically, those deal with numbers. For example, the population in the Matsu Borough. From 1985 to 2000, the population of the Matsu Borough grew by 140%. During that same time, across the inlet, Anchorage's population grew by 28.6%. Together, the region of South Central Alaska, Matsu, and Anchorage grew by 44.5%. And so you know a little bit about our side of the inlet in Matsu. The communities of Kinnick and Goose Bay, the area that will receive traffic from Anchorage across the inlet, if incorporated, would be the fourth largest city in Alaska. The area has more people living in it right now than live in the combined cities of Palmer and Wasilla. From 2000 to 2010, the traffic counts on Kinnick Goose Bay Road, and I've included in your packets a list of, or a map of the traffic fatalities and injury accidents on that road, grew from 12,590 cars to 18,308 cars. Current calculations indicate that accident rates on KGB, again referring to the map in your packet, are nearly twice as high as the rates on the Seward Highway. And there's a lot of conversation in the news and among people who follow transportation issues about the accident rates and the concern for safety along the highway safety corridor of the Seward Highway. I have with me today to answer the questions that unfortunately I'm not able to answer, the technical questions. I have Mike Foster, the chairman of the Board of Kubota. I have Jeff Stark, the attorney for the Board of Kubota. And I have Kevin Hemingway, who is the CFO for the Kubota Board. And let's see, Mr. Chairman, I think those conclude my comments. It was just a brief introduction that Senator Huggins wanted to give you on this bill, again, given your familiarity of the topic, and to leave open the opportunity for public comment, which I understand you'll be taking today.
Great. Thank you, Jody. Thank you very much for providing a presentation on the bill. Does anybody from Kubota want to add any further information?
Drop this.
Dropper.
For the record, my name is Michael Foster. I'm the chairman of the Kanikoram Bridge and Toll Authority. And I appreciate the opportunity to present a little bit about the project and to be able to answer questions on behalf of the project. Basically, or frankly, this gets down to new, much-needed infrastructure in not only South Central Alaska, but Alaska as a whole. It is not a connection between point A and point B for the municipality of Anchorage and the Matsu Borough, but it's actually the infrastructure that would be important to the western side of the Cook Inlet, interior Alaska, and frankly, all to the state, because the way this, the project is structured, the net revenue over time would actually go back to Title 23 projects statewide, which could be from the marine highways to airports to harbors to even boardwalks in rural Alaska. The Jody had talked a little bit about or touched a little bit on some of the population in. Frankly, you know, I think that one of the most important pieces of this project starts with the population projections or population growth in South Central. And out of that comes the traffic growth that's expected. As Ms. Simpson talked about, the growth between 1985 and 2010, and those are actually recorded numbers. Anchorage grew by 28%, and the borough grew by 140%. And the whole South Central area grew approximately 44.5%. The projections from 2010 to 2020-35, and there are several different models that have been looked at, and I'll kind of summarize the models, try to answer some of the questions that we've had in other hearings and other committees about the differences in the models. The Department of Labor did a model in 2012 for South Central Alaska, and it showed a growth in the Anchorage area, or in Anchorage at about 26%, and it showed a growth in the borough at about 80% and an overall South Central growth of about 39%. ICER also did a model, and I have been criticized before about using the ICER numbers, but I will point out that the ICER model and ICER project was actually funded through the state through the Department of Transportation. So we look at it as public domain information. ICER did their model in 2009, which was before the census, and they showed that the growth in Anchorage was roughly 20%. And the growth in the borough was roughly 90%, and the overall growth in the South Central is about 37%. They showed the growth in the Matsu Borough, which is one of the key components to the traffic demand on the Glen Highway. The borough in 2010 was approximately 90,000, and the model that ICER did in 2009 shows that the is about 170,000. So about 80,000 additional population in the Matsu Borough area. The ICER model, the 2009 model, compared to the actual 2010 census, as all models are a prediction of time. It's looking in a crystal ball, and, you know, a year out it's pretty clear. 20 years out it gets a little foggy. But if you look at the model that was done in 2009, the model actually underpredicted the Matsu growth by 9.8%. And what we did was we took the ICER model, the same factor of growth and stuff, and we just plugged in the 2010 census numbers as a current or an established baseline. Based on that, the ICER model, if corrected to 2010, would actually show a growth of 127% or a population of 190,000. That's a population growth of about 100,000 over those 25 years. Now, we also have a model, the state or Kubota also has a model of Anchorage and Matsu Borough and South Central. our model for the Mat-Su borough, the same time frame, showed a growth of 128%. We're talking about 1% difference over a 25-year model. Both our models are a little less than 100 in population between the two. They both show about 100,000 in additional borough residents. The overall area in South Central actually grows by 45%, and I like to compare that or look back to actually 42%. Sometimes I say you got to look in the rearview mirror to see where you're going forward. 42% over the next 25 years compares to the 44% over the last 25 years. Anchorage, the prediction is Anchorage will grow by about 24%. In the last 25 years, they grew by 28%. The borough will continue to grow. It's at 128% in our prediction. Last 25 years, 140%. So relative-wise, it's fairly consistent. One thing it does show in these models is, and this is through the AMATS, through the Transportation Planning Municipality of Anchorage, is almost half of the growth in the Anchorage area occurs along the Glen Highway, or more specifically, it occurs north of the Glen of the Eagle River Bridge. Eagle River to Chugach to Peters Creek out to Aklutna grows by a population of almost 74% in the model. And that is 44% of the total population growth that's predicted for Anchorage. So if you look at the population by itself, what you see in the model, what you see in the past 25 years, is substantial growth along the Glen Highway from Eagle River out to the Mat-Su borough. And you could say that's from Palmer to Wasilla to connect Goose Bay and parts thereof. From the population comes what I call the critical component, and that's traffic, because this is all about transportation. If we're just talking about population growth, we'd be looking at land use models versus transportation corridors or transportation needs. The Glen Highway in 1985 at Aklutna, again, a measured number, was about 15,000, or it's actually 15,700. Average daily traffic count, that's in 1985. In 2010, that number grew to 29,700. You saw an 89% growth in traffic in 25 years from 1985 to 2010 at the Aklutna overpass. That's the first measuring point coming in from points north. And I won't say the borough, but just points north.
Was that the same number of lanes?
Between 85 and 2010? No, that's two lanes. Okay. But the traffic, so the Glen has been expanded over those 25 years. Okay. Our prediction, based on the population models that I went over briefly there, between 2010 and 2035 at the same place in point, the traffic count will be approximately 65,000 vehicles at Aklutna. Seems pretty staggering, but when you look back in time and you look at the population in 1985 and the number of vehicles, you look at the population in 2010, you look at the number of vehicles, the population of 2035 isn't unrealistic compared to what you see in the rear view mirror. Highland, which is the next measuring point, which is just south of the Eagle River Bridge, which is where the sixth lane starts, in 1985, there was 33,000 vehicles. Part of that was sixth lane, but it wasn't sixth lane all the way out to Highland. But there was 33,000 vehicles in 1985. In 2010, there's 52,000 vehicles. Kind of gives you an idea of what the Glen looks like two years ago. The Glen traffic increased by 52% in those 25 years. The Glen today is basically what we call a design capacity, which means for the highway speeds and the traffic counts, that's where the highway should be at. It doesn't mean you can't add more vehicles to it, and you can add more vehicles to any road until it becomes a parking lot. But the design capacity for a national highway system, we're basically at capacity. And frankly, that's one reason why through the GO bond that there's another lane being added on the southbound bridge at Eagle River is to handle that traffic coming onto it. Our projection at Highland, based on the population models that we have discussed, in 2035, just, you know, actually 22 years from now, is 110,000 vehicles. Okay. You look at that and you say, man, that's just staggering. I'm not sure we're going to have 110,000 vehicles north of the bridge, north of Eagle River. However, remember in 1985, we only had 33,000. In 2010, we had 52,800. Okay. So you kind of see the correlation between population and traffic. Now going to the west side of the inlet, there's a lot of discussion about who would use this bridge. You know, why would we build this bridge if people are going to still use the Glen? This is all about transportation again. The Knit Goose Bay Road, you know, and in most places in Alaska it might be called a highway, but it's called a road. In 10 years, between 2000 and 2010, the traffic count on that road, Knit Goose Bay Road, which is the road that brings the west side inlet traffic to Wasilla and then to points beyond, went from 12,600 to 18,400. So in a 10-year time span, it increased by 45%. It also, based on the federal highway, and they do their accidents rates based on fatalities and major accidents on a 100-million-mile ratio, the Knit Goose Bay had a 22-point something as far as the ratio of fatalities and major accidents to a ratio of 14 for the Seward Highway. Gives you an idea, and if you look at all the transportation corridors, the Knit Goose Bay Road is the most deadliest road in the state. Although it's called a road and not a highway, it is clearly the most deadliest road in the state. Now, and Ms. Simpson also touched on the amount of traffic or the population at the end of Knit Goose Bay Road or that portion thereof. And I know Senator Dyson is very familiar with that area, and I'm sure Senator French is also. If that area incorporated today, there'd be roughly 17,000 people in that area. 17,000. It would be the fourth largest city in Alaska. Although, you know, I'm from Eagle River, and I said if Eagle River succeeded from municipality Anchorage, we'd be the third largest city. But so it's just a matter of how you break it up. But the point is that area does have a fairly well-known population. The Knik area, Palmer-Wasilla combined is about 14,000 people. So that area already has 17,000 people. Now, critics will talk about the use of the bridge and amount of traffic on the year one, year two, and I like to kind of use analogies so folks can kind of see what that would look like. Year one, we're predicting, or our model predicts, about 3,000 vehicles cross it one way every day. Okay, average daily traffic count, which is really 6,000 because you figure 3,000 one way and 3,000 the other way. That is similar to what you see on DeArmond or Huffman in Anchorage. Okay, so it gives you kind of an idea of what we're looking at for traffic and now what our traffic model looks like. Because you tell somebody, you know, 6,000 vehicles, and they just think, wow, that's a lot of vehicles. But then you look at the Glen, that's doing almost 60,000 vehicles now. You know, so now we know as the population starts to expand there, both from land, for residential, business, commercial, industrial, that you'll see growth. And, in fact, the models actually show in the initial years there's more people from Anchorage going that direction for economic or for jobs than there are going the other direction as you're building that infrastructure. Now, keep in mind that with or without a bridge, the Mat-Su Borough in that area is growing. The Knik area is the fastest growing portion of the borough, even without a bridge. That area is the fastest growing region. The state has a correction facility there. There's rail extension coming into Port McKenzie. Port McKenzie is developing as a resource development. That area is growing. It is not, and I quote, it is not a bridge to nowhere. There's actually something there already. This is just new added needed infrastructure. In 2008, DOT did a study of what it would take to expand the Glen based on their traffic predictions. And that would be the Glen going to a 6-lane going north and an 8-lane going out to the North Eagle River where a large portion of traffic comes on. In 2008, DOT estimated that it cost approximately $3 billion to expand the Glen over these 25 years to handle the traffic capacity. So you have to ask yourself, you know, do you use STIP money to expand the Glen, or do you look at another possibility of a public-private partnership with toll revenue to build infrastructure that based on our models, will have a net return to the state over the life of the concession. Now, I will not say that in the initial years, and this is reason as a reserve fund, I will not say in the initial years that we actually have to draw from this reserve fund to make to subsidize our availability payment. But based on our traffic model, based on the populations that I've given you, about year 7, year 8, we'll start putting money back in that reserve fund. And over the course of a 45-year model that we have, about $2.2 billion in net surplus can be used for Title 23 statewide. And if you have a transportation fund in place, this is the kind of project that would help fund that transportation, not only for Anchorage and the Matsu Borough, but for Southeast Alaska, rural Alaska, any Title 23 eligible project. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Michael. Questions? Senator French.
Yeah, just a couple questions. Do you know how much money we've spent on Kubota so far to date, the state and federal money, just what the rough house totals are?
I'd have to look it up exactly, but it's $75
million. About $75 million altogether?
Yes.
Okay. And going to the bill, the Section 2 raising from $500 million to $600 million in the amount of the bonds that the authority could issue, could you talk about that a little bit and why that's necessary?
Okay. And I apologize earlier to the chair. I didn't go through the chair, but through the chair,
he's pretty casual,
Senator French. Every once in a while I get pointed out that I got to follow procedures. But we currently have, through the safety loop, we have a capacity of $600 million. When the legislation was created, it showed $500 million. And so all we're asking is to increase the capacity to match the capacity that we have through the private activity bonds.
I hate to, if I can just follow up, Mr. Chairman, I hate to ask why we did anything, because it's sometimes hard to know why we do anything on this side of the table, but why did we write a bill that had $500 million in it if Safety Lou had given us $600? What was the hang-up at the time, if you know?
Well, I wasn't here in 2003, so I really couldn't answer that. I could certainly research that for you. What I do know is that our capacity is $600, and through statute we have $500, so we're just increasing it.
Okay, and maybe you can just explain why the safety loop is even a relevant point when it's the state that's, in essence, giving you the authority to issue the bonds. I mean, if safety loop gave you $5 billion of the bonds, we wouldn't authorize you to issue that many. We'd pick the right number, right? I mean, that's our job.
Well, through the chair, Senator French, the public-private partnership is the private entity is responsible for financing. And so either through a TIFIA, loan process, or through private activity bonds, or through private financing options, the private sector will acquire the financial part of the project. All we do in the safety loop is provide a mechanism if they want to tap into the private activity bonds as federal government. So we're not actually financially responsible for the private activity bonds.
So we don't need to issue bonds? We don't need this part of the bill?
Well, we actually, through the private activity bonds, we actually issue them. We're the conduit for them. It isn't a bond that we actually underwrite, though.
But we still have to give you the statutory authority to issue them.
You have to give us, right? Currently, we have the statutory authority to do $500 million. This increases to $600 million. All we do is provide the private partner the ability to go to safety loop as a financial mechanism. It doesn't mean they're going to.
And another question, if I could. Thanks. About the TIFIA funding, what happens if we don't get money from TIFIA? What would happen to the project if that doesn't come through?
Well, if I could, through the chair, Senator French, let me first address why it is we think we're going to get TIFIA, and then I can certainly address the what if, because we also have that too. Is the TIFIA under Map 21, there's about $17 billion in capacity that's out there. Currently, there are 29 letters of interest into the Federal Highways Administration for TIFIA. And this is basically a Greensfield-type loan process. And, in fact, if the developer uses the TIFIA loan, a payment isn't required for 5 years after completion. And then it's a very, very, forgiving, but it's a very lax pay structure. And in the initial years, you're paying interest, and it increases. And the whole purpose of this is a greenfield-type project. So there are currently 29 letters of interest, and we're one of those. There are 18 states that have applied for it. We're one of those states. At 33%, and that's about what we believe the TIFIA program is going to finance, although we did ask for the 49% because there is a 49% ceiling, but it doesn't appear from the federal highways that they're going to allow many projects to fall under the 49% because they're trying to...
Even the 49th state?
That'd be great. I wish it was that easy. I think in our next letter we'll point that out to them and see if we can get it.
Probably shouldn't do that, but that's a nice idea.
But at 33%, the $17 billion in capacity actually equates to $51.5 billion in new infrastructure. And this is the beauty of what I call the MAP 21. We believe, and there should be a letter in your package and stuff that actually came from Federal Highways, major projects. I've actually had two one-on-one meetings with Secretary LaHood, Secretary of Transportation, and I've also briefed the major projects group. I have met with their undersecretary on the TIFIA. When I was in New York in June, I asked them to write us a letter that says what it is that we need to do in order to advance in the TIFIA process. It should be in your package. There's a letter that basically says they want to see the commitment of the state. Also in your package should be a letter from the governor back to TIFIA that says it's his intent to fund this. And if you look at his funding of it, you'll see there's $10 million, then there's 35, and with the intent to have the $150 million funded by the time it opens. So we feel pretty confident. And someone asked, well, how confident is confident? And I said, well, I feel 90% confident we'll get TIFIA. I feel 100% confident we won't get TIFIA if this bill doesn't pass. There's a guarantee that we won't be in the running if we can't show that the state is behind this project. Okay, so one's a guarantee, one's a Michael Foster guess. Okay, so we feel pretty confident of the TIFIA. However, you know, as any good business sector guy, if we don't get TIFIA, it equates to probably about $100 million additional cost to the state. Okay, so to be upfront, honest, forthright, if we don't get TIFIA, the PABs would become more valuable than to the private developer. TIFIA is right now a little bit over 3%. The PABs are a little bit over 5%. They're not as forgiving. You have to start paying back on those soon after you draw on them. So it's about $100 million worth of costs. Now, how would we handle that? Well, frankly, we'd probably be coming back for additional appropriation to the reserve fund. And that's assuming that the traffic count doesn't ramp up to match some of our projections. The other option is to do a milestone payment up front to pay down part of that capital. And that can also be done through STIP or Title 23 funds. Okay, so there's some different mechanisms to do it. Long answer to your question, but it's a complicated process. TIFIA means about $100 million to the project in low finance money.
It's a complicated topic, and I didn't expect a short answer, so that was a good answer. Thank you. I think there's someone else.
Ms. Simpson.
I just wanted to point out that I did not include the original TIFIA letter. I included the governor's response and the response from Senator Huggins in support.
Right. Great. Thank you. Mr. Hemingway, did you want to provide additional testimony?
Mr. Hemingway, Chairman Michael Foster, Mr. Hemingway and Jeff Stark also with the Department of Law, if there's any questions related to what I call the legal side of it, they're here to address the committee. And if there's anything related to the financial part of it, certainly Mr. Hemingway can address that too.
Great. Thank you. Senator Craig, you have a question of the Attorney General's office? Senator Dyson. Any questions? We do have a few people signed up to testify, and again, I apologize for the late start time. We were in other business, and so we had a late start time, but I do have folks that have signed up to provide testimony. If we can keep it brief, please. Thank you very much. Mr. Foss, for your testimony, and thank you very much, Ms. Simpson. We do have the mayor of the Matsu Borough, Larry DeVelvis. Mr. Mayor, would you like to testify, please?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I will be brief because I'm late for my next meeting. I just want to know that every mayor in the borough here totally supports this project. We also have a resolution that was passed by the Alaska Conference of Mayors under the Alaska Municipal League supporting this as an indication that this is of importance to the broader state, not just Anchorage and the borough. In anticipation of the growth that's already moving towards the landing of the causeway, we're building and already have bonded and we'll be starting construction this summer on a new high school, middle school, out towards the end of KGB Road. We're laying out two town sites that are out there, one of which is already surveyed and monumented. So we are going places, and this project is a very significant and necessary piece of our infrastructure. I learned recently here that of the 1% of Alaska that's privately owned, 30% of that is right here in the Matsu Borough. So we've got a lot of room to grow, and by the way, we anticipate increasing that privately owned percentage of property as much as we can as we move ahead.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Mayor. Questions from the committee? Senator Mayor, thank you very much for taking the time to testify. And we have, thank you. And we have Jamie Kenworthy. Mr. Kenworthy, you're here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jamie Kenworthy. SB 13 greatly expands the state's liability from the existing Kabata statute. The new language says the legislature must appropriate funds to make annual payments to the contractor to pay off the bonds. And then in Section 5 of the SB 13, the state shall fund Kabata's overhead, admin costs, and working capital. I believe a moral obligation for agency self-defined operating funds is unprecedented. So what's the state's liability for this project, which counts on future tolls to make the annual liability payments? Four problems. First problem, overestimated toll revenue. Wilbur Smith's Kabata's traffic and toll consultant has an average overestimating error rate of 118% for the first 5 years of all their national projects have been open. That's more than a factor of two. Those numbers come from the Transportation Research Board of the National Academy of Sciences. Kabata says there will be $4.2 billion in toll revenue over 35 years. My estimate is half that, or $2.1 billion. 50% less toll revenues, both in line with the consultant's average overestimating error rate and what happened when CH2M Hill modeled ICER data for the highway to highway project. They had less than half the vehicles crossing the bridge in 2035. Two Wilbur Smith projects have already gone bankrupt, and a few more are having their debts restructured, which is bond talk for the state having to come up with more money and the bondholders having to take a haircut and stretch out the repayments.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Excuse me, sir. Back a page. Where is the section that says the state must pay these things?
It does not say moral obligation, but under Section 5,
yeah.
Kabat has identified their cash needs for admin, working capital, and overhead. If you ask any bond counsel, the language of when you establish a reserve fund and when you ask for an appropriation is the language that triggers the moral obligation of the state. So at that point, through the chair, Senator, you will have a choice of funding the reserve fund to make up for whatever amount is needed by what Kabata defines, or you will renege, in effect, and the credit national rating agencies will note that language, which I believe is a contingent liability on the state's balance sheet, will then basically ding the state of Alaska. So I believe if this bill passes by next fall, Kubota will issue a 35-year contract, you know, for billions of dollars. This language will be in a place to fully replenish the reserve fund to meet that moral obligation, and the credit rating of the state could be, you know, the rating agencies will notice that the state of Alaska is now doing unlimited contingent liabilities, and you'll be downgraded. Fitch right now has us at AAA. Standard Poor's and Moody's have us at AA+.
All right. May I follow up?
Sir, does it?
Yeah, forgive me. I'm an engineer, not an accountant. But so because the fund, if you will, is a creation or a creature of the state, if the fund goes in the ditch, all the assets of the state are there to back it up, in essence?
It's a little more complicated, but yes. The language that you need to replenish the fund is customary language for establishing a moral obligation. So first, they would say that there's too little money in the funds. And a TIFIA application that Kubota submitted a year ago was clearer. It said any time it gets below $50 million, they will ask the legislature for an appropriation. It was a footnote on their financial plan. And when that happens, that's when the legislature has two choices, appropriate the funds or have Wall Street notice that you have a contingent liability you're not funding. Right. You won't find such language in ADA and HFC. You know, you don't have this kind of reserve fund for operating funds in HFC or ADA.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. So the second problem is the missing $500 million, because Kubota was turned down last fall for the TIFIA loan. The third problem is the latest financial phase one plan includes impossibly derived revenue from what has to be four lanes after 2025, but the plan only pays for a two-lane bridge out to 2051. Kubota has to either take $1.9 billion out of the revenue forecast, because that's the maximum load for a two-lane bridge, basically when you get to 20,000 feet a day. Or Kubota needs to put in $550 million to $800 million for a four-lane bridge in Phase 2 and the connection to Ingrid Gamble. The numbers in the last six financial pro forma plans I've looked at really move around a lot. You know, a few years ago, the 2010 one had $7 billion in availability payments. Now we're at 2.7. But they all have one fixed number, which is basically you need to show a minimum bond cover ratio of between 1.25 to 1.4. That says you got $1.30 to pay $1 of costs. So my opinion is they've all been reverse engineered. You start with a bond cover ratio you need, and then you work back to the traffic and tolls that will get you to that number. So last year in the TIFIA application, in the 2011 plan, they asked for a $300 million loan from TIFIA and showed $600 million more in toll revenue than this year's application, which basically has asked for a $500 million loan and has $600 million less. That's moving around a lot. The last problem, why is this a public-private partnership deal instead of direct state bonding? By Kubota numbers, the contractor is putting in $73 million of equity in the pro forma that you have in your packet and taking out $738 million in net cash flow for financing the deal at 12% return rate for 35 years. My estimate, this is the one cost I believe that they've overestimated. I think it's going to be $150 million less. But that's still basically an extra $500 million because you're guaranteeing the contract with this deal. And then they just take that contract to Wall Street and issue the bonds. So why should the state that can borrow at less than 4% be guaranteeing a contract that's going to pay them 10 to 12% over 35 years? That's, you know, that $600 million is just sent outside the state. It doesn't buy anything. So why the complicated P3 structure? My guess is this is the only way to sell the bridge as if it will be free. Or it's it's going to bypass the capital budget process. Bottom line, my estimate of what the bridge will cost minimum is $2.6 billion, or $3,500 per Alaskan, plus the $2 billion in tolls. So if this bill passes, you know, that's what's going to happen is they're going to sign a contract, you're going to guarantee the contract, and then the credit ratings are going to notice this, and everything else that the state wants to bond for will have to pay a higher interest rate. So I think the whole deal is a house of cards, and it's only held up by a state guarantee. And if I can have 20 more seconds, I'd like to give a different answer to Senator French's question. Matt. And that is the original statute said that they could issue bonds and had to be no more than 125% of the bond buyer index. In other words, investment grade. Well, this new statute, and that was when the private sector was going to share the risk. But in this new section, you are fully guaranteeing a reserve fund to replenish the unlimited liability of this project. And therefore, it's all public sector taking the risk. And so they don't have to worry about whether the market would give it an investment grade. It's just a matter of they'll just look to you. You, in effect, are acting as the guarantor.
Thank you, Mr. Kenworthy. We have about 8 minutes left in our committee meeting. And we do have three people lined up to testify. And if we do have time left, I will afford Mr. Foster the opportunity to provide conflicting testimony.
I'm going to stay late a bit if you want.
Okay, I have no problem staying late. I don't know about Senator French, but I would like to get rid of the folks that have signed up and are in the LIO to provide testimony. So, Suzanne DiPietro in the Anchorage LIO, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Great. Provide your name and for the record, please, and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Suzanne DiPietro. I live in Anchorage, and I've been following this project since 2004. I've carefully reviewed Senate Bill 13, and at the risk of providing slightly tedious testimony, I'd like to bring your attention to some specific language that takes the unprecedented and needless approach of obligating the state to cover unlimited shortfalls in the Knick Bridges project expenses, and that's the moral obligation that Mr. Kenworthy just testified about. But I just wanted to take you briefly through the exact sections of the bill that create this obligation. So starting on page 2 of your bill, at lines 25 and 26, you'll see that Kubota already has the power to create what I'll just call a sort of a plain vanilla project reserve fund. So that's existing Alaska Statutes 1975-221H. Now at the bottom of that page, and going on to the top of page 3, you'll see the first new item, which establishes that you will appropriate money into this reserve fund. Then continuing down just a bit on page 3 at lines 8 through 17, we see that Kubota must use the money that you've appropriated into the reserve fund to pay its debts and obligations. So now with these two additions, we've created a special kind of reserve fund, different from just what I'll call a plain vanilla reserve fund, into which you will deposit money and out of which Kubota will pay its operations and maintenance, including its contractual availability payments to its private partner. Now, continuing, there's one more element to this structure, and that's continuing on to page 4 in paragraph L at lines 5 through 9 of the bill. We see that Kubota each year must tell you and the governor how much it needs to cover its debt, and you may appropriate that amount. While this procedure may seem innocuous on its face, as Mr. Kenworthy testified, this is the language that signifies to the rating agencies your pledge step in and appropriate money to the reserve fund for each and every year that the revenues are insufficient to cover the debt. So although you will not see the words moral obligation anywhere in this bill, if you pass this bill as it's currently worded, the markets will understand that when Kubota signs its contract with the private partner, you will appropriate money to cover all those obligations to make availability payments, which Mr. Foster just testified will need to occur for at least the first seven to 8 years of the project, or whatever other obligations Kubota incurs. In other words, the markets will understand that Kubota's operating debt is backed by the state of Alaska. Now, it is true that this legislation doesn't require you to appropriate the money every year, and you could decide not to. However, a failure by the state to honor the moral obligation is treated by the markets as a default, and the markets would be expected to react adversely by downgrading the credit rating of the state of Alaska in general. On that point, I would encourage you to review Commissioner of Revenue Butcher's letter to Senator Thomas, which is, I believe, in your packet, and Senator Butcher warns about this exact hazard. So by passing this bill, you'll be setting yourselves up for a Hobson's choice. Refuse to appropriate and damage the state's credit rating or continue to spend the money that we may not be able to afford. Another, just one more point. Using a moral obligation reserve fund to cover operating expenses has never been allowed in Alaska for any other moral obligation reserve fund. There are other reserve funds that might be used to cover, for example, debt service, but never, it's never been done in this way to cover these types of availability payments, and it should not be allowed for this project because it would greatly expand the already significant financial risk to which the state would be exposed by this project. And even aside from any question of default, just passing this bill could create the type of financial exposure that would cause the rating agencies to have a negative reaction when reviewing the state's credit rating for future bond issues by the state. If Gabata needs a project reserve fund, existing legislation already allows it to create one without roping you into continuous appropriations for the life of the project. Please delete sections 4, 5, and 7 of this bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions from the committee? Senator Dyson.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony, ma'am. As I understand it, the state presently has north of $10 billion worth of unfunded liabilities must be $70 or $80 billion in something like cash reserves. Would this potential liability here have that much effect on our bond ratings, given our present debt load and reserves?
On that, I would urge you to consult Commissioner Butcher's letter. But I have consulted with bond counsel in preparation for this testimony. An attorney here in Anchorage who's very experienced in the bond markets and in public finance, and he has opined to me that yes, this would have an effect. It could have as much of an effect as possibly one step downgrade, because of the sort of the unlimited nature of the exposure. I mean, this isn't a type of liability that you could actually put a number on. It's really essentially unlimited because you're really sort of obligated to appropriate each and every year for the life of the project, which.
Thank you.
If we believe Mr. Kenworthy's testimony, and I think we should, would be several billion dollars.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Further questions from the committee? We have two more people signed up to testify. If it's okay with the committee, we'll continue with the last two folks to testify and try to use brevity at this point. Next to testify, Bob French. Mr. French, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Bob French, and I am no relation to Hollis French.
Good.
And these comments are my own. I'd like to offer some additional information about what I believe are misstatements that have been made by Kabata, mostly at the House Transportation Committee hearing Tuesday. The TIFIA loan. There is more money available for TIFIA financing this year than there has been in the past. There is also very strong competition. Once administrative overhead and obligation limitations are figured in, Federal Highways anticipates having $690 million available in fiscal year 2013 and $920 million in fiscal year 2014. Those actual dollars are leveraged around 10 to 1, so $690 million is able to provide about $6.9 billion of TIFIA-backed loans for fiscal year 2013. Kabata's chair, Mr. Foster, testified 2 days ago that none of the TIFIA letters of interest have gone forward to the evaluation stage. That's not true. A week ago, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that $1.5 billion to replace the Tappan Zee Bridge in New York would move to the next stage of the TIFIA loan process. Successful TIFIA projects will pay flat annual fees to the contractor. Kabata's numbers show project cost flow is negative for the first 9 years, That's using a 49% TIFIA, not the the many more years that it would be if they had only 30 or zero TIFIA. And that they're still showing ballooning annual payments starting at $25 million in year one, going to $104 million in year 35. Other successful TIFIA projects have real private sector sharing, sharing the risks. This one is all public money with a toll consultant's report that has a very strong disclaimer to it, saying basically, don't use this information to support any financing plans. Mr. Foster also told House Transportation that Kubota had not really been turned down five times by TIFIA. He suggested that the previous four times, they were really not trying. Well, if that's the case, I'd want to suggest that that is not rational economic behavior for Kubota's financial consultants to be paid millions of dollars to produce those finance plans if they weren't really trying. Before moving this bill, you need to evaluate Kubota's financial plans that don't include 49% of the project costs coming from TIFIA. They haven't provided that to you yet. Toll revenues come from population, just as Chairman Foster said, and they also come from jobs. And it's informative to look at how those estimates have changed over the years. Is it reasonable to predict that there will only be 30 new jobs in the Willow area by 2035 compared to the 13,828 jobs that Kubota estimates will be created in the first half mile on the west side of the bridge? How about zero new jobs near the Buffalo Mine Road or 169 new jobs in the entire Butte area? In 2007, when Kubota was predicting a Mat-Su population of 250,000, the population and job estimates were spread out all around the borough. Back in 2007, Kubota estimated only 6,740 new jobs at the Point McKenzie area, less than half what they were predicting in those same exact areas in 2011, when the borough population was estimated at approximately 190,000, like Chairman Foster said. So what changed? With less population but still needing to show high traffic counts, it appears Kubota's 2011 forecast was revised to include additional jobs in Point McKenzie in order to justify both north and southbound traffic crossing the bridge to go to work. Does anybody really believe Kubota's estimates that the bridge will collect $595,000 of tolls every day in 2051, or that an equivalent of 2.5 diamond centers of retail will spring up in an area that the borough has planned for tank farms and coal loading facilities? Another example of flexibility in Kubota's consultants' prediction is shown in the gross estimated toll revenues. In 2007, they estimated $7 billion in toll revenues over a 40-year contract for their P3 partner. In 2010, they estimated $12 billion in toll revenues, but that was over a 55-year contract. In February of 2011, they estimated $4.8 billion for a 35-year contract, but in December of 2011, it was $4.5 billion in 34 years, and then their last financial plan from August 2012, it was $4.2 billion for a 34-year contract. That $600 million of lost toll revenue that they estimated changed over a period of only 18 months. That's four times higher than what Kubota has said that the is the maximum amount that they need for their reserve fund.
Mr.
Obviously,
French,
these numbers are highly flexible depending on what numbers you put in there.
Mr. French, can you summarize?
Kubota's consultants may have a lot of experience, but since I do consulting work for my business, I understand how much pressure there is to provide numbers that meet the client's wishes. Yes, there are different circumstances for each one of those different financial scenarios, but the more likely reason is that the numbers are being reverse-engineered to fit the revised circumstances. You really need to be able to look at the how reasonable Kubota's estimates are, and that's exactly what the LBNA audit and the Department of Revenue audit.
Mr. French, can you summarize, please, because we're going to lose this room in a short amount of time, and we have three other people that have signed up.
I urge you to not make a decision on this until you get
Mr. French,
information on the LBNA audit and the Department of Revenue audit.
This bill is going nowhere today. We're just taking testimony, and thank you for yours. And we have three other people signed up to testify. Aves Thompson from ATA, Alaska Trucking Association. Mr. Thompson. And if we can try to keep it brief with the next. Great. Welcome and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Aves Thompson. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Trucking Association. The ATA is a statewide organization with nearly 200 member companies, and I will be mercifully brief. I am here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 13. We support the project, and we support the legislation that will advance the project. We believe that the bridge will provide a vital new link in our regional transportation system. It will provide an additional route into and out of the Port of Anchorage. It will provide some congestion relief on the Glen Highway and the Parks Highway, and it will ultimately set up an efficient freight corridor to interior and northern Alaska. And that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you very much for your brevity, Mr. Thompson. It's good to talk to you again. Next to testify, Thomas Pease at the Anchorage LIO. Mr. Pease, welcome, and provide your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Thomas Pease, and I appreciate the opportunity to address your committee today. I'm here to give some perspective on the history of this project that could influence your vote on Senate Bill 13. The momentum for Kinnikahn Bridge originated with federal earmarks, around $110 million in seed money, of which Kubota has spent over $70 million. But even a large gift from Congress is not enough to sustain a project as expensive as the Kinnikahn Crossing. In addition to the federal earmark, Kubota has sustained itself on a promise to build a bridge that will require no state money. With Senate Bill 13 before you, that promise is broken. Instead, passage of this bill would hand a blank check to Kubota, signed by the state of Alaska, for the entire cost of the bridge, which some estimates place at $2.5 billion. The Kinnikahn Bridge is on AMAT's short-term projects list only because Kubota assured the Anchorage Assembly 3 years ago that this project would not have any state money to build. The Anchorage Assembly pressed hard on this point as they were concerned a project as expensive as the Kinnikahn Crossing would consume state transportation money badly needed for other road projects in Anchorage and throughout the state. Kubota guaranteed the assembly that the Kinnick Bridge would require no state funding. With that guarantee, the Anchorage Assembly moved the Kinnick Bridge project from the long-term to the short-term AMATS list. This new AMATS listing enabled Kubota to pursue federal TIFIA loans. But even with the bridge now on the AMATS priority list, Kubota was denied TIFIA loans on five separate attempts. Why? Because even a federal loan agency recognizes this project to be a high-risk project with likely cost overruns and inflated traffic and toll projections. Once federal earmarks dried up, Kubota shifted its financial focus to PPPs, or private-public partnerships. For several years, Kubota was telling anyone who would listen that private investors would assume all risk in the bridge project, that they had some of the largest international investment firms knocking at the door, and it would be just a matter of months before they would have a contract. 3 years ago, I publicly debated a Kubota employee on this issue, and she adamantly insisted that Kubota was actively negotiating with private investors, that no state money was on the table, and that a signed contract was imminent. Here it is several years later, and Kubota still has no private partner. There's a reason no private partner has signed a contract. Cost projections are understated. revenue forecasts inflated, and the project is too risky. Today, Kubota will tell you that they still have private partners eager to sign a contract and build the bridge. And they do. But the private partner will sign only if the state of Alaska guarantees 100% of the cost of the bridge, including cost overruns and toll revenue shortfalls. The private partner gets paid up front, and Alaska is left with billions in debt. Senate Bill 13 is, in essence, a blank check. This check is for more than the stated $150 million, since language in the bill requires the legislature to replenish this amount as needed. You, as senators, must decide to sign this blank check. If you've thoroughly read this bill and you truly understand the financial implications of this bill, if you consider yourself a fiscal conservative and truly believe in smaller government, then you will hold this bill in committee. Thank you.
Mr. Pease, yeah, thank you very much for your testimony. And again, it's not the intention of the committee to move this bill out at this time. So last person to testify, Lois Epstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Lois Epstein, and I am an Alaska licensed engineer. I live in Anchorage and serve on the AMATS Technical Advisory Committee. However, I'm speaking for myself today. Despite what you may have heard, the proposed Kinnickahn Bridge is not ready for construction, nor is it a financially sound investment, nor is it reasonable to assume that the bridge will improve safety on South Central roads. The Kinnickahn Bridge and Toll Authority expects to get a federal low-cost loan, the TIFIA loan, for $500 million. However, it has not received a TIFIA loan during its five attempts, and therefore there is an enormous hole in its budget. And I urge you to continue pressing the Kinnickahn Bridge and Toll Authority for their financial plan with that. We heard today that it was a $100 million shortfall, but we need to see all that in writing. Their proposed toll is among the highest in the country, so many people are likely to take the Glen Highway alternative to and from Anchorage, not to mention the increasing use of telecommuting and thus not even moving by a car. Additionally, Kubota's toll revenue forecasts are based on their consultant, C.D. M. Smith's, projection of population growth in the MATSU, which is far greater than that from other sources, including the Alaska Department of Labor and UAA's ICER. To make matters worse, their consultant's projection puts almost all the future growth into the western part of the borough, which knowledgeable experts believe is unrealistic, and not putting that growth in the Wasilla Palma area. Unfortunately, the state's plan to do an independent audit of bridge toll revenue recently was canceled. And as you probably know, the recently issued LBNA audit findings about Kubota have not yet been addressed. According to the real cost of the Kinnickahn Bridge, $2.6 billion plus X dollars, a document which you have been given, there are substantial costs to the state unaccounted for by Kubota in its materials and testimony. I urge you, as legislators, to do your job and ascertain how much this project actually will cost the state on an annual basis prior to approving these bills. Remember, inadequate traffic projections resulted in more than a $2 million annual subsidy for the Whittier Tunnel, and that's a much smaller toll project. Please do not support SB 13, which would provide a state guarantee to private investors when there is inadequate toll revenue to cover bridge costs. The bridge is not a wise, fiscally conservative investment and will harm the rest of Anchorage's and MATSU's transportation infrastructure by siphoning away dollars which would otherwise go to maintain and upgrade existing roads and bridges. This money would go to out-of-state investors and their shareholders via the profits they will achieve. We'll go to out-of-state investors instead of upgrading our existing transportation infrastructure. Thank you for your attention to these important concerns.
Great. Thank you very much for taking the time and sticking around to provide your testimony, Ms. Epstein.
Thank you.
Senator French.
I see someone with their hand up.
Yeah. Ms. Simpson from Senator Huggins' staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to ask you on behalf of the bill sponsor who could not be here to allow the Kubota just 2 minutes wrap up.
If you can, Mr. Foster, if you can provide us 2 minutes, we're going to have to get the heck out of here.
Appreciate
it. And we're not moving the bill today anyway. And we'll, you know, if we need further testimony, we'll be more than happy to accept that as well.
Thank you, sir.
And we thank you for taking the time. Again, we apologize for starting at such a late time, but your boss's fault, by the way. Mr. Foster.
So, double thank you.
Thank you. Again, for the record, my name is Michael Foster, the chair of Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. And there's been a lot of discussion, public discussion, public comments on the project. I'd like to, in summary, just wrap up a few, and I know that when we have another hearing, we can address additional comments. Nowhere have we tried to deny or mislead the legislature about the moral obligation language. We clearly know it. You clearly can see it. There is a moral obligation language on behalf of the state for the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority to make their payments to the private partner. Remember, the private partner is responsible for financing it, designing it, building it, operating it, maintaining it, and collecting tolls for 35 years. If there are construction overruns, if there are construction schedule delays, we won't talk about a project in Anchorage that has recently seen that kind of overruns. And on this project, those overruns fall to the developer. They do not fall back to the state of Alaska. Once the contract is entered into and signed, the only thing the state is guaranteeing is that we make our payments, our availability payments, and it's called availability because it has to be available for traffic. We make our payments. They're kind of like a lease payment on a building. We make them as long as we're using it or we have access for it. The infrastructure belongs to the state the whole time. And so I have to ask, being a good Alaska citizen from the Glen Allen area, is if you're asking a private partner to spend about $1 billion to build infrastructure for you, he's taking on the risk of the project, and you're entering into a commitment to make those payments, well, I would only expect the state to make those payments contractually. That's where the moral obligation falls into. So any testimony or any suggestion that we're trying to hide this in the bill absolutely is incorrect. We know we need the moral obligation of the state in order for this project to move forward. Just so I think that to the chair of Senator Dyson, I believe there's about $1 billion of moral obligation on the books. This, I got this from Department of Revenue. That moral obligation, I believe, falls at ADA. So this project here would probably add about another $1 billion in moral obligation. And honestly, it's about $1.14 billion in moral obligation that would be added to that. And again, it's the moral obligation of the state to make their payments to the developer. We share our risk. Our risk is the traffic revenue. Their risk is the design, construction, and operation of the facility. A very clear-cut separation between the public sector and the private sector. I'd be more than happy on the next hearing to address some more points or some of the other public comments, but that's kind of a wrap-up. I kind of like to end with that note.
Great. Thank you very much for coming down and providing your testimony, Mr. Foster. And again, Kevin, thank you very much for showing up, and Mr. Stark for being here just in case, and from the Attorney General's office. And also, I want to thank Mike Rovito for not including brochures and things. Sorry. Anyway, thank you, Senator French. Thank you, Senator Dyson. And again, Dana Owen, staff to transportation. And Krekelberg, secretary, telecommerce officer, or operator. Henry Deterney, thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.